With not much but a heart full of hope, Rosemary McCoy left her family's tin-top shack in Arkansas in 1942 and made her way to New York City.
Well, I think it was a blessing that I was able to do it, because a lot of people couldn't get to first place.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with biographer Arlene Corsano. Her book, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll, The Life and Music of Rosemary McCoy, chronicles this prolific African-American Arkansan songwriter.
Her dream was to make it big as a singer. Instead, by the mid-50s, she achieved fame and fortune as a songwriter.
But I know one thing, I was really one of the fortunate ones. It's like almost everything I wrote got recorded.
Arlene Corsano and the life of musical pioneer Rosemary McCoy on Arts and Letters.
Rosemary McCoy is one of the most prolific and versatile songwriters ever.
No, I read in a magazine where you wrote songs. You sent in $35, they'd make you a demonstration record on your song. That's why I thought you had to pay people to sing your song.
Top artists in the fields of jazz, rock, gospel, country, and blues have recorded her creations. Many recording more than one. Elvis Presley recorded 2, Nat King Cole 3, Sarah Vaughan 6, and Ruth Brown 11. But for all her success, Rosemary McCoy remained quite humble, giving credit to God for her ability.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today, we'll be talking with biographer Arlene Corsano about singer and prolific songwriter Rosemary McCoy, whose songs have been recorded by legendary artists like Ike and Tina Turner, Nat King Cole, and Elvis Presley.
I made demonstration records on my own songs, and almost every one that I made got recorded right away because they liked my phrasing.
McCoy's styles were as diverse as her songs, blues, jazz, rock and roll, pop, gospel, and country. And McCoy's turbulent life and tumultuous music are told through excerpted tape recordings of Rose McCoy.
To make a demonstration record, you find a singer you want to use, and then you use a piano, and sometimes you use a 3- or 4-piece band.
And by her biographer, neighbor, and friend, Arlene Corsano.
She achieved fame and fortune as a songwriter, producing many records and even starting her own publishing firm.
The life and times of Rosemary McCoy, coming up on Arts and Letters. Biographer Arlene Corsano, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You said that although she's written over 850 songs, not that many people know of her.
I think part of the reason Rose isn't known as well as she should be is that she was an independent songwriter. She wasn't connected to a music publisher. Now, Carole King and the other brill-building female writers that are more well known, they had music publishers to push them, to push their legacies. Music publishers would promote them and try to get them into the Songwriters Hall of Fame and keep pushing the songs. But Rose did this all on her own. She had to make the connections. She sold the songs. And in my book, I had to go to 36 different music publishers to use the songs I used. I think I used about 49, maybe just one line, two lines, sometimes more. And that's a lot of music publishers to deal with. So not one of them felt they owned her or that they were going to put any finances behind promoting her legacy.
and she was a bit of a spitfire, too.
Well, I ain't gonna wait for you no more down here, down here.
I noticed throughout the book, she was working for so many different music labels, and sometimes she would be fired, sometimes she would walk away. Sometimes there were great deals that she had an opportunity to get in on, like with Stoller and Lieberman, and she didn't do it. She seemed extremely independent. And did that come from her roots in some ways growing up in Arkansas as a farmer's daughter?
I think it's from her roots, but she also seemed to be more independent than even the rest of the family and more willing to take risks to do things like go out and bring home a poisonous snake on a stick, and her mother and father just, you know, went wild, and she would do things like that. She wasn't afraid. She was very self-confident, fearless, persistent.
Well, in school, I've worked in the principal's office as a typist. And then I worked taking care of a little baby, 9 months old, after school.
I ain't gonna stay home every night, down here, down here.
Some of that came from her roots, I'm sure, the persistence of that a farmer needs to be hopeful, needs to deal with whatever comes down the road, and that's what she did.
Yeah, you chop cotton in the summer when the cotton was small, and then when it bloomed and cotton came on, you had to pick it. And my father sold it.
Down here, when this message reaches you, I'll be loving someone new, 'cause I ain't gonna wait for you no more. Down here, down here.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to biographer Arlene Carsono talk about the life of American songwriter Rosemarie McCoy. Tell us about why you became so interested in her work. The book is called Thought We Were Writing the Blues, but they called it Rock and Roll. And each chapter, by the way, is a song title. Why the interest?
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, which was her most prolific period, her most successful period. She kept writing for decades after that, and she even had one song in the 1940s. But she knew a lot of the singers that I idolized. Jackie Wilson, he kissed her one day.
Baby, a kiss from your lips.
And Johnny Mathis, she worked with him. She met him outside of the studio, and then she worked with him in the studio. And boy, everybody was in love with Johnny Mathis back then.
And your crazy little love-making ways really got through to me.
And then there were the big names like James Brown.
Dig us up a mess ago. The minute we found a buried treasure, I looked up to see a great big old 8-foot giant looking dead on me. And that dude, you know, and that dude, I didn't have no more eyes for digging up no more gold. No, 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 no.
And Aretha Franklin.
It's pitiful. Feel so sorry for me. Though you don't love me, you say, but still you won't set me free. Oh, set me free.
And Frankie Lyman.
Frankie Lyman. Oh, she was one of the last people to see him. He was at her office. He was going to do one of her songs, and they were to meet the next day. And the next day, while she was sitting in her office waiting for him, someone called and said that he had passed.
I can feel it ticking through my
Rosemary McCoy wrote Nappy Brown's first hit, Don't Be Angry.
So, don't be angry and drive me away. I knew I was wrong. Please let me stay.
And she told me the story about it.
Nappy Brown, the manager, brought him. But Freddie Mendelson discovered him, and his manager brought him up here from North Carolina somewhere, brought him up to my house, and he had that song, Don't Be Angry, and that was his gimmick. And we wrote that song at my house. And after that, he was a big star.
And I interviewed him, and I thought, wow, it would be great to hear what he remembers. Now, that was his first hit. And I was asking him about this, and this was being videotaped, and he said, no, I don't remember. No, I don't remember. And he was a little ill at that time. He was still performing, but he was very tired. He had a heart condition. And so I just kept asking him, and he couldn't remember anything. And I give him details, and no, I don't remember. And you would think that somebody would remember their first hit. Mm-hmm. So the cameraman says to him, boy, Rose was really good looking, wasn't she? And all of a sudden, he picks his head up, his eyes get big, and he says, she was something, boy, she was something. Walk down the street, everybody be looking. Dressed her head off.
And she was, these pictures of her in your book, she was just beautiful.
Yeah.
You said she was small, and she had a kind of high voice.
Maxine Brown described it when she said, she came to her with a song, and she said, and Rose sang it right there in the office with that little voice of hers.
Some old evil chick always telling everybody she come from Chicago. Got Mississippi written all over.
Like little, not so much when she was older, but when she was younger, it was a little high and a little sweet. I think you can hear it in Gab and Blues, Big Maybelle's first hit, because Rose is doing the talking on that record.
You run my business.
Look who's got business.
Oh, I'll have to do what I hate to do.
Go ahead and do it. Ain't nobody scared of you.
And there's a great story about Ike and Tina Turner, too.
Rose wrote, I think it's going to work out fine. And she shopped it around, and she said nobody was interested. So Sylvia Robinson said, come to the Apollo backstage, and I'm introducing it to Ike and Tina Turner. I think they do a great job on the song. And Rose went there, and first she met Ike. He called Tina into the room, and he said, sing this song for that girl.
I want to tell you something, Ike. I've been to see the preacher man.
A preacher man? You must be losing your mind.
And she sang it. Rose said like her life depended on it, and then just got up and left. And Sylvia Robinson, who was her friend, and she was Mickey and Sylvia, people would know her through that song. She took it to a record company. They made the record that night. Rose didn't go because she thought, oh, well, nothing's going to happen. And it became a hit. It became Ike and Tina Turner's first top 20 hit.
Darling, yes, Tina.
You start to get next to me.
That was my
and also their first Grammy nomination.
Darling, I never thought this could be.
I just have to say that was not Ike, Rose said. Sylvia told her that was Mickey Baker of Mickey and Sylvia who did the talking on the first record, the first recording of I Think It's Gonna Work Out Fine.
You're listening to Arts and Letters. We're talking to Arlene Corsano about her biography, Thought We Were Writing the Blues, But They Called It Rock and Roll, The Life and Music of Rose McCoy. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Arlene Corsano talk about the life of American songwriter Rosemary McCoy.
We had our own farm. For a while, though, we were just renting it. But then we ended up buying it. My mother bought it.
Let's talk about her early life. And the pictures you have in here are phenomenal. That picture of that 10-roof shack with the wallpaper that was newspaper print. And the very humble beginnings from Arkansas.
Well, they were very poor. Rose was born in 22, so she was only 7 when the big depression hit and things got even worse for farmers. They were on a 40-acre piece of land that at first her parents were renting. And the children had to work on the farm. There were 3, Rose, a sister, and a brother. And Rose was the youngest. And as soon as they were able, they went out and chopped cotton, picked cotton, dug potatoes, and cut the corn. So they always went to school late. They did go to a 2-room schoolhouse, which was a little bit of a distance from home, but they could never go on time because they had to wait until the harvest season was over.
Her father was a farmer, and this was in Oneida, Arkansas.
Oneida, Arkansas, in Phillips County, and it was a very small town. She described her town as a little small town. You're passing through. They even own you passing through. But there were 3 general stores in the town, but she didn't get there very often.
Gonna wait you no more down here.
And she was born Marie Hinton.
She was born Marie Hinton. When she was 18, she added the Rose to her name. She married James McCoy.
Right.
She became Rosemary McCoy.
So her father was a deacon in the church, and I think it's important that the Delta, where she was born, is the birthplace of the blues. She was a very good student.
Yes, she was. She even got a scholarship to Philander Smith because after 8th grade, she went to Eliza Miller High School, which was in Helena, Arkansas, and she had to go there because there was no school for black students near Oneida. And Helena was not around the corner. It was maybe 16 miles away.
And I stayed with my grandfather and grandmother because they asked my mother to let us come up there and go to school, my sister and my brother. And my father and mother used to bring food up for me, for all of us, really.
And she was voted queen of the football team and most friendly. What was her relationship with music? I know she was in the choral club.
Well, most of the music that she knew when she was young was gospel, because she sang in the 2 churches, her mother's Baptist church and her father's Methodist church. And it was gospel at home, too. She and her sister would sing at night in front of the fire. Didn't have any radio, of course. They had no electricity and no radio, no record players. So the only time she got to hear other music was when she went to the town of Oneida, because 2 of the general stores had jukeboxes. And those jukeboxes would play jazz, like big band jazz, maybe Ella Fitzgerald, and country and western. She also had an uncle who had a car that he kept in that garage, and she would sneak in there and listen to country music, because she said that's mostly what was on the radio down in that area was country. But that was about it. Unless she was in Helena, and when she was in Helena, she would stand outside one of the blues clubs, especially the Hole in the Wall Club, and listen to the music. She said she loved the blues, but of course she couldn't go in. They would have thrown her out of school. They threw her grandfather out of church for going into one of the juke joints. And Helena was known for its juke joints. There were several there.
Yes, I went to the doctor with my head in my hand. The doctor said, Big Bill, I think I'll have to give you monkey glands because you just keep on drinking. Yes, I keep on drinking.
And she was in Helena because that's where she was going to high school. Right.
Right,
she's
right.
Living with her grandma. To the degree she spoke about it, what was her high school experience like?
She loved high school because she joined all those clubs. The choral club, the home economics club, the debating team, and of course, being voted most friendly was, you know, was a plus. She just loved school. She just loved being there. But she was poor, and she worked a lot. And she worked a lot so she could buy clothes, because someone insulted her once by saying, "Oh, you never get nothing new, do you?" And she was going to beat that girl up. And in fact, she told her to meet me outside after. But she said she never did, because she just hugged me instead and I didn't beat her up. And you wouldn't think that she was that tough, because she was very thin at the time, but she was. And that was her way of taking care of things. But then she wouldn't hold it against people, you know, like children can do, and then forget about it. She was very good at that.
So in 1937, a 14 to 16 piece orchestra came to her school called the Sweethearts of Rhythm, and that would be Lawrence C. Jones.
He put the group together. Back then, they were like the Jubilee Singers. Colleges were sending out choral groups to make money. And it was a school for poor children. They were going around making money, the Sweethearts of Rhythm.
So she sees the Sweethearts of Rhythm, and she kind of says this is what she wants to do. That was the real turning point, to the point where she decides, after she sees this and she graduates, she's going to go to the Catskill Mountains in New York.
She heard about a summer job up in the Catskill Mountains watching children, and she thought, well, she's done that. She'd be good for that. And it was one way to get away from home, because her parents weren't going to let her go. Finally, she convinced her father, and her father convinced her mother to let her go for this summer job, because in the fall, she was supposed to go to Philander Smith. She said she was scared, but she says, I was excited too. She took the bus on the way up, and she remembered the bus driver said to her, "You don't have to sit in the back here anymore, little girl." And she said, "Little girl, I was, you know, like 19 years old and 5'7". She said, "But I had my country hat on."
She takes a job, and you called it a sleep-in job, and she takes this job with a couple watching children.
I got a job up here on a sleep-in job. That's how I got up here. And they paid my way. Up in Hurleyville, New York. I stayed up there exactly 1 month, and then I came into New York.
And she likes the first couple a lot that she's with. And then another couple tells her that she can come with them to the Bronx. And she takes that, and that's not a good experience.
No, that was a bad experience. The first woman would try to fatten her up. She said she'd give me bananas and cream to put some meat on her bones.
Was she in touch with her family in any way?
Well, she was. She wasn't supposed to leave. Her mother wrote the woman in the Catskills not to let her daughter out of there, not to let her go anyplace else. Her mother must have known Rose had something in her mind.
"I got me a 19-year-old jitterbug, and all my neighbors get jealous when they see us hug. I left my house this morning about 3:30. They all hushed their windows and started peeping at me."
So Rose wrote a letter as if it were from her cousin to herself that lived in New York someplace, and said, "She's going to come and live with me, and she's going to night college."
"They ought to stop tipping in my business. They ought to stop tipping in my business. Because I'm old enough to do just what I want to do."
But of course, that was Rose, you know, trying to get out of there. So the woman let her go, thinking it was okay. And she had a good relationship with her parents. I mean, they were still loving, but I think they probably thought she was a little bit too independent.
"I had me a party, lasted all night long. They all started looking like something was wrong. I came in tipsy last Saturday night. The next day, somebody told me that wasn't right.
And then she goes down to the Bronx with a woman who was vacationing up in the Catskills with her husband and her children. And she says, I'll get you jobs down close to New York. She was in the Bronx, which is part of New York City. And Rose goes down there, and the woman just kept complaining. She didn't clean right. And she wasn't paying Rose at all. She was just going to teach her how to clean right and get her a job. But she didn't do that.
And they were paying her by allowing her to live there, essentially.
Why don't they stop dipping in my business? They ought to stop dipping in my business. 'Cause I ain't nobody's fool, and I do just like I want to.
There was that scene, and it kind of startled me a little. She said she would have cut the woman. There was a point where the woman wouldn't let her out of the house because she wanted to leave. She said, I'm done. And she had met someone who was going to help her a little bit, or she thought would. She said she gave her a look that the little
probably
baby
did.
Starts crying, and she was upset.
When I play the number with the number man, I can hear them gossiping all they can. Honey, don't let me come home riding in a Cadillac. They all be digging me when I get back.
She told me, she says, I was even thinking, I'm up north. I could even cut a woman. Of course she couldn't. She would have been in a lot of trouble. And the woman said, you know, you're a minor. She wasn't 21 yet. You're a minor, so I'm going to call the police.
I play my television way up loud. And every time I do it, I draw a crowd. They all start looking with their faces frowned. But I can't help it if they just ain't down. They ought to stop dipping in my business. They ought to stop dipping in my business. 'Cause I'm old enough and I do just like I want to do.
And she wrote a song about the experience in the Catskills. If I had any sense, I'd go back home.
And I think that was also about New York City, because she would heat cans of soup on the radiator just to get by. She had to pay the rent, and then to sing at night, she had to have nice clothes, which she didn't have.
Well, they had an MC that told jokes before you brought your own. And they had chorus girls, and then they had tap dancers.
I was standing at the railroad crossing, soaking wet with rain.
And then they put you on, the singer, come on last.
Now I realize fortune and fame is not for me.
On fresh show, 10 o'clock, and you're out of there by 2:30.
And all these pretty stories ain't what they cooked up to be.
And Louis Jordan recorded that one later.
Louis Jordan recorded If I Had Any Sense, I'd Go Back Home. And then it was in the Broadway show Five Guys Named Mo.
It was up-tempo in the play. But the play is what really did well for her.
Right, they up-tempoed it. She didn't like that, but she said she didn't mind it as much as if somebody touched her lyrics. She said, because I don't like it when someone changes my lyrics, because that's my soul down on paper.
What was her relationship with Louis Jordan? He's a fellow Arkansan, and he used to call her homie.
She used to go to clubs and see him, and when he found out she was from Arkansas, because he loved Arkansas, he would just call her homie. And she never used her connection with him in the 40s. She knew him in the 40s because he'd be playing in New York a bit, not until she had her first hit, because she thought that you didn't make much money with songs.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Arlene Corsano talk about the life of American songwriter Rose Marie McCoy. We'll be back in a moment. This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Arlene Corsano as she talks about the life of American songwriter Rose Marie McCoy.
No, the first song I wrote, a subsidiary of Decca. And a group, a girl called Muriel Gaines sang lead, and the Dewdroppers, they did the background.
After all the things they told me, and I know them to be true.
Because the first song that she had recorded was 1946, and sometimes I see 47. And that was After All. And it was kind of a pop jazz thing. But she said it made her like $18. And she said, oh, shoot, I thought you made a lot of money writing songs. So she stopped showing them around. Not that she stopped writing songs, but she didn't concentrate on that.
After all, I'm so much in love with you. It seems there's nothing I can do but wait.
And knowing Louis Jordan helped her later down the road, because she got into a situation where she had given two songs to two different people, and she was worried that one of the record companies was going to sue the other.
She was staying in the Mann's Hotel. She said, I couldn't afford staying in these fancy hotels. But the Mann's Hotel was in Detroit. She went to Louis Jordan's room, and she knocked on the door and just sang him two songs off a piece of paper, gave it to him, and he recorded one of those songs, but not the second song, at least not right away. So when she got together with songwriter Charlie Singleton, they were showing each other what they had written. And Charlie Singleton saw, If I Had Any Sense, I'd Go Back Home. And she said, well, we can't do that. I gave it to Louis Jordan. And Charlie Singleton said, oh, he probably lost that song. But he didn't. So they rewrote the song up-tempo and gave it to Atlantic Records for Ruth Brown at that same time.
I left home one morning in 1944. I left my baby crying, crying in his back door. I came to the city, I thought I'd find success, but all I found was trouble and unhappiness.
And that same time, Louis Jordan record came out also.
And he talked to her and said, hey, I'm recording your song.
Yeah, she's
and she's like, oh, great.
125th, looking down the street, says, hey, McCoy, I did that thing today. She says, what thing? He said, if I had any sense, I'd go back home. She said, oh, no.
I was standing at the railroad crossing, soaking wet with rain. Now I realize fortune and fame is not for me.
It's in the Broadway play, Five Guys Named Moe. Now, that's one of the very first songs I wrote when I first came to New York. And it's called If I Had Any Sense, I'd Go Back Home. But it's in Five Guys Named Moe.
I remember the day I caught the train. I was standing at the railway crossing, so it went with rain. Fortune and fame is not for me. And all those pretty stories ain't what they're cooked up to be.
Let's talk a little bit about meeting up with James McCoy again. She dated him a little bit in high school, and that didn't turn out. And then she saw him as he was waiting for a bus.
He had broken up with her because she went to a dance with somebody else. He was working in a restaurant and had to work the night of the dance. Rose had a new dress, and she wasn't going to not go to the dance. So there was somebody whose name was Pettis. He had a car, and he was going to take her to the dance. And she said, well, he's just a friend. And James said, you can't go to that dance. She did, and then he broke up with her. And
but then in 1943, she sees him again.
Yeah, she goes back after a year up in New York. She goes back home to visit. She runs into him on a bus in Memphis where her sister was living. And they hook up again, and in 3 days, they get married.
Because he's going off to...
Yeah, he's going to Germany. He's in the army, and she doesn't see him for well over 2.5 years.
So when she's in New York kind of early on, and you talked about some of the clubs, there was something called mixing. What was that?
Mixing was going to the clubs and singing, entertaining, but then in between sets, you're sitting with the customers, and you have to get them to buy you drinks.
You're running around with somebody else. I'll you through your big head. Turn around and shoot my doggone self. I know you doing something, something ain't right. Got a strong intuition, time you stayed out all night. Oh, but listen to me, Daddy.
Rose didn't drink liquor at the time. So one of the bartenders showed her how to take a drink with a Coke chaser and then spit the liquor out into the Coke. And she's told them, she's like, well, I don't drink. I have them order me Coca-Cola. And they said, but that doesn't make us a lot of money. So she had to drink and she had to sit around with the customers and make nice because most of the customers were men.
Cause one man had already done me wrong. You say everything is gonna be all right. Cause Dad is gonna take care of you. But the first thing you did was mortgage my house. Now the payment's overdue. Oh, but that's all right, baby. Just don't spend my money on nobody new.
In the Bronx, when I moved over here, I used to have a lot of entertainers over here for barbecue, outdoor cookouts. We danced, sang, everybody did what they did. Mickey Baker played the guitar, Jimmy Rushing sang. Jack Hammer, that wrote Great Ball of Fire with Otis, he was over here. But we and him worked over at the Leon Cocktail Lounge.
Another gal in my car, right where I find you, I'll leave you where you are. Oh, now I've warned you, Daddy.
So she was taking any singing job she could get, and she's living in a variety of different apartments, it seems, but one was not very far from the Apollo Theater. And she became a welder in the Bronx Naval Yard, but she's singing. Would you tell the story with Pat? Because to me, that epitomized her in a lot of ways, because she, you got to be tough, and tough at that time, tough as a woman, tough as an African-American woman, and tough in an industry that just is going to eat up and spit you out.
Pat was a piano player in a club in New Jersey, and Pat was about 40 years old. And here comes Rose, who is very beautiful, and maybe now she's 20, 21. And Rose had this dress on where she couldn't put the money anyplace, so she gives it to Pat to just hold on to until she gets off stage, and she forgets to get the money back from Pat. So the next day she goes to Pat, and she says, oh, that $16 I gave you. And Pat says, what's $16? And Rose says, I gave you $16 to hold for me. And Pat knew she did, but she just stole her money. Then later on, Rose is sitting at the bar with a gentleman mixing. And along comes Pat and pushes her off the seat. And the man gets very angry and tells her, you do that again and you'll be in the corner, or whatever he told her. He told her something about she better not do that again. So the boss takes them back to the ferry. There was a ferry that went over from New Jersey to Harlem. And in the car on the way over, Pat slaps her. So Rose says, I'm not going to do anything in the car because the boss is there. And they get out and they go to get on the ferry, and Rose grabs her and knocks her to the ground and starts knocking her head into the ground. And a policeman comes by and pulls her off and was going to arrest her. But there were men around there that said, oh, don't arrest her, just let her go. And she did. But on the ferry, she hears Pat talking about she's going to cut her. You know, cut her face so nobody will look at her. And Rose says, well, I'm going to get her. She says, I wasn't afraid. I was so angry, and it was so cold on the ferry, the air. She says, I just said, well, I've got to get her first. But then Pat never did. Pat had drunk quite a bit that night, and she just said, you know, if I wasn't so drunk, you never would have been able to beat me up. And that was the end of that. And they never saw Pat again. That's the first story that Rose told me in the car. I remember I was going someplace. It was Rose, my cousin, and myself. And Rose is telling us this story, and we're looking at each other. This is a 79-year-old lady who's got a very sweet voice and a very sweet disposition and seems to love everybody. And here she tells us this story.
And to me, at least, you know, I'm glad you told me that it was the first one, because this one, to me, epitomized so much of a representation of what happened in her life in the book in some ways, too. Not the violence, but she was always on the edge. But she was often rescued, too, by either people thought she was pretty or that they thought she had talent or that she was in the right. I mean, she was big about being honest.
Yes.
And in the right. And
yes. But very forgiving. If she thought you were wrong, she could forgive.
Sure, I like Cab Calloway. Everybody talk about it. I do it. Say Cab treats me like a dog. He does. Treats me like a dog. He called me a dog. Yes, he did. What did he call me? An old dog. Sometimes I wished I was a dog and he was a tree.
She began opening for a variety of comics. The first was Mom's Mabley. Talk about the Chitlin circuit and that whole relationship with comics and working with comics from Mom's Mabley to Pygmy Markham.
How'd it done, sir? I was reading in the paper, at least a friend of mine read it to me, rather.
And Nipsey Russell was Nipsey part of her life, too.
Hey, Nipsey Russell!
Where have you been?
What do you want to know? What do you want to know?
Where have you been?
What do you want to know where I've been for?
Boy, I was at home lying in my bed.
Yeah?
Thinking about the money that I owe you. And I just couldn't sleep.
Couldn't sleep?
No, I had to get up out of my bed to come over and find you and tell you.
And she thought about being a comedian at one point.
Rose said she always wanted to be a comedian until she realized that she was laughing at her jokes more than anybody else.
Wait a minute, Luther. Don't play it like that, Luther. Play it like you're playing for one of them big people, you know. Make it pretty and one of them symphonic stuff, all that stuff. Hey, honey, make me look like Lena Horne if you possibly can up there, Mr. Lightfast. That's better, baby. Come on, Luther. Knock me out,
Luther. So what about Mom's Mabley?
So Mom's, she opened for Mom's early on in her career on the Chitlin circuit. And she went out to the Midwest. Rose never went down south on the Chitlin circuit. The Chitlin circuit did go down south. It went up the East Coast and to the Midwest. But she did mostly the East Coast, the Midwest, and she went up to Canada also a bit. And Mom, she had to do her hair. So it was part of the job, and she opened for her, and she thought she was a very nice lady. And the book has a picture of Mom's looking like normal, you know, without that floppy hat.
Right. And she would do her hair with a curling iron and
she liked that job. She wasn't crazy about going on the road, especially after her husband came back from the war, but she still did, and he was encouraging her to go out. And
Mom's Mabley had a kind of a gravelly voice. She sang too. She was not a great singer, but she did sing, and she had even a popular album in the late 60s.
Yeah, about 68. Mom's Mabley was one of the oldest people to have a top 40 hit. It was Abraham, Martin, and John that Dion had done previously.
Has anybody here seen my old friend Abraham? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seems the good die young. I just looked around and he was gone.
So Mom's made a lot of comedy albums, but she made that one serious album that Abraham, Martin, and John. And it had one of Rose's songs on it. Not that Rose and Mom's Mabley kept in touch. It was just that moms probably heard it because Nat King Cole recorded this song. It was One Son. It wasn't a hit.
One sun shines from heaven and lights up the whole wide world. One sun shines from heaven and warms every boy and girl.
What was her relationship with her husband at this time? Because it seems to be in the book a bit of a sad story where she's very much in love with him. She is enamored with him. She thinks he's very good looking. He goes off to war and he comes back and she wants to meet him at Penn Station. And the homecoming is not what she hopes for.
No, he comes home and she wants to hug and kiss him and he's kind of cool. I don't know if it was from being over there or was that just a sign of what was to come later on? Because he would be there and then he wouldn't be there. And there was a lot of suspicion about what he was doing. She was out in the Midwest doing a tour that she didn't want to go on it because it lasted 3 months. And he said, oh, I'll come out and I'll come visit you. Go, go. He kept pushing her to go and she goes. And when he was supposed to show up, he doesn't show up.
And she's pretty devastated.
She's pretty devastated.
And so many of her songs seem to be a push and pull, the lyrics between the relationship with her husband and then the temptations of the road, but also just kind of a profound sadness.
I burned your letter that told me goodbye. Told me we were through, but didn't tell me why. And I put up a chair and I sat by the fire.
Was the relationship? Did she talk about it?
When people asked her, I was backstage with a couple of singers and they were talking about who got divorced and she said, well, she never divorced James and she was glad because she had his pension at least. Because though she should have had loads of money, she was cheated so much and she wasn't really paying attention to things. She really didn't, but she could live, but his pension certainly helped. But they asked her about, you know, James, why didn't you divorce him? And what was it about him? And she says she didn't know. She just said there was just something about James. But you wonder what it was like for a man in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s to have a wife making more money than him, hanging out with all these men and some pretty good-looking men, coming home late at night because you're in the recording studio.
Hanging out in pretty difficult clubs. I mean, you tell the story about how when Rose's father comes to visit, he's appalled.
They had their own club, and she takes him there, and he said, how could you take me in the club with these hellions?
And then I had my own nightclub in Passaic, New Jersey, called Mitz's. And sometimes I used to sing in there, but usually I hired singers. Like, we had Red Fox.
Love is just like going fishing, way, way late at night.
We had Gloria Lynn.
She may be weary. Women do get weary wearing the same shabby dress. But when she's
had well, Big Maybell came over and worked one night and she didn't show back up.
Tune in next time for part two of Arts and Letters. They Like My Phrasing, The Life and Times of Rose Marie McCoy. featuring her life in show business and discussions of many of her songs. Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Thank you to all the musicians and songwriters whose songs elucidated this episode. A special thanks to Darius Nelson and the St. Mark Baptist Choir for the organ music and the hymn. Thank you to Mary Ellen Cubitt for helping to produce this episode. Thank you to Frank Thurman for all the helpful advice. Thank you to Adam Simon of Simon Sound for mastering the episode. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to biographer Arlene Corsano for allowing us access to her taped conversations with Rosemarie McCoy, and whose biography allowed us an intimate portrait into the ambitions and concerns of this uniquely talented and prolific American singer and songwriter. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of Rosemarie McCoy.
I feel great. I like being up on the stage. I especially like that. I like watching the reaction of the audience. And they react to lyrics, I notice.